Hello, I'm Richard Penson, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's podcast entitled Expanding Options for Immune Checkpoint Inhibitors in Frontline Advanced and Recurrent Endometrial Cancer. Today's program is supported by a joint educational grant from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck & Co. Incorporated. I am Richard Benson, a physician at Mass General Brigham and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. I'm also the IRB chair at Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center in Boston. And I'd like to welcome my friend and colleague, Jonathan Lederman, who's professor of medical oncology at University College London Cancer Institute and the UCL Hospitals London in the UK. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to speak to you today about endometrial cancer. Thank you for having me.
I think you're one of the foundational figures in our world. And there's no sense of being locked in the past. You're also one of the people who is continuing to define the future. So thank you for your investment. Just give us a bit of a sort of a timeline of discovery for where we're at today with these breakthroughs in immunotherapy, the changing patterns of disease and disease burden.
Endometrial cancer has really undergone a complete revolution in the last few years, from a disease where really there were very few options to manage patients, particularly with advanced disease or recurrent disease, and we were really faced with patients with a lot of tumor, a lot of comorbidity, who often responded very poorly to chemotherapy, and only a proportion of whom benefited from hormonal therapy. And so it was a really difficult disease to treat. And what's happened is sort of two things have come more or less in parallel. One is an understanding of the complexity of the biology of the disease. And that's gone hand in hand with the development of a completely new class of treatment for the disease, namely immune checkpoint inhibitors. And the two sort of came a little bit together, but one has led to the other, as has so often been the case in
Yeah.
oncology. You just
Following the science is just fantastic.
you just get an opening, and the whole scientific field explodes and continues to do so. And we now know that this is a very complicated disease, defined by different biological processes, different pathways, if you like, which are prognostic in some cases, but actually also predictive for a response to treatment with some of the novel agents that we have.
I think one of the things that really drove home to me in the last week, the youngest patient in SOLO-1 getting PARP inhibitor switch maintenance was 29. And I've had just a little handful of 20-year-olds. And the sort of change in disease patterns is really interesting, the genetics of that. And then after platinum and taxane in endometrial cancer, offering a patient an anthracycline with less than a 10% chance of benefit used to be like, just futile or close to futile. Now, with antibody drug conjugates, it has blown that out of the water, which is very exciting. And then the hope, the greater hope for immunotherapy is fantastic. So just list out the molecular subclasses to help us think about what we're talking about.
Right. Well, just again, to go back in time, we did just about two things molecularly. We used to test whether the tumors were ER positive, because that might help us decide whether the patient should have hormone therapy at some point. And we recognized that, particularly amongst serous cancers, many of those behaved very much like ovarian cancers and indeed had a P53 mutation. So that was really where we were at until really only a few years ago. And that was when we started to understand that about a quarter of these tumors had deficiency in mismatch repair. And consequently also increase in tumor mutational burden. Now, both those made these tumors very responsive to immune checkpoint inhibitors. And really, the first studies started to come through a few years ago. These were sort of phase two studies of a variety of different immune checkpoint inhibitors, all showing that in those tumors that were deficient in mismatch repair, there were really quite incredible responses. And not only were these responses high, but also many were very durable. And going on from that, you know, we understood that many of these molecular markers were not exclusive. That is to say, you know, you could see P53 mutations in non-serous tumors, in some endometrioid tumors, and the whole spectrum has sort of crossed over, so that we now, in addition to obviously, you know, hearing what our pathologists say about whether this is endometrioid, low or high grade, serous, clear cell, and so forth, we now would routinely request a number of molecular markers that would give us not only prognostic information about the patient, but also predictive, particularly whether or not the tumor is likely to respond to an immune checkpoint inhibitor.
Mm.
So we would, you know, check whether the tumor was mismatch repair proficient or deficient, and that can be done simply by immunohistochemistry, whether or not there's a P53 mutation, because we know those tumors do worse and would be much better suited to have chemotherapy, recognizing, though, you know, the drawbacks of chemotherapy. We would, of course, test for ER receptor status. And in most cases now, we would also look for an unusual marker, a mutation in polymerase epsilon POLE, which we know confers a very good prognosis to patients, and actually is also changing the way in which we consider treatment by reducing the amount of treatment that we might give to a patient that has a POLE mutation. So
yeah.
these are now becoming really incorporated into routine pathology and routine evaluation of our patients before treatment.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've really enjoyed is that the pathologists have sort of come along with us, rather than sort of histopathology eclipsed by molecular biology. They're sort of ER, P53, mismatch repair, HER2. We cannot test for POLE at the moment at the Great Mass General Hospital, but those other ones really redefining things. And then, for example, KRAS and sort of feeding back, now our pathologists are much more commonly calling tumors mesonephric-like. That sort of integrational development, I think, is very exciting. So tell us about mismatch repair in terms of upfront immunotherapy strategies for recurrent metastatic or persistent endometrial cancer. Do you call it mismatch repair or microsatellite unstable high?
We call it mismatch repair deficient. I think that's because, you know, that the immunohistochemistry tells us that, you know,
right.
that's the test we would most usually use. You know, there has been a tendency sometimes to say, well, if they're not mismatch repair deficient, they must be mismatch repair proficient. And that's not a term I like to use. So I sort of talk about non-DMMR and DMMR as the two main categories. And really what we've seen recently in clinical trials has shown us that in patients with recurrent endometrial cancer or advanced disease, which is not, you know, surgically resectable, that these immune checkpoint inhibitors, particularly in that DMMR group, lead to high response rates and really excellent progression-free survival rates. And, you know, now being incorporated into our treatment protocols.
Fabulous. So I think Dave O'Malley's study, which for me was really helpful phase two, that sort of exciting histologically agnostic development from the KEYNOTE study, is pembrolizumab really works in these deficient mismatch repair tumors. And then Dave O'Malley, the single agent pembrolizumab study, well, I forget what it was, 68% response rate or something, but a good response rate, a durable benefit, as you say. But this sort of suggestion that in the really sensitive tumors, a year of pembrolizumab really transformed outcomes for those patients. They really, you'd got a certain number of patients into a deep and durable response to immunotherapy. That was great. And then the phase threes, tell us a bit about the standard of care changing, the new defining of standard of care by the phase three clinical trials.
So we sort of had two key studies that were presented and published last year. This is the NRG18 study with pembrolizumab, and then the RUBY trial, the ENGOT-EN6 study with dostarlimab. And so both of these trials, patients received chemotherapy with carboplatin paclitaxel, and then either immune checkpoint inhibitor or placebo. And both those trials showed that there was a particularly strong effect in terms of PFS in that dMMR group. Actually, in the RUBY trial, there was an improvement overall in the whole population, which included the pMMR population. And we have now the overall survival for RUBY, which confirmed that difference with dostarlimab. We haven't yet seen the mature data from the NRG18 study, but there's every reason to believe that it's going to be similar to the RUBY trial results. So that I think has sort of crystallized our thinking about bringing in one or other of those immune checkpoint inhibitors in that dMMR group. I think where there's still some areas of uncertainty is the group that is non-dMMR or pMMR. And I think it's important to remember that that's a heterogeneous group, both histologically and biologically. And so we can't just sort of put them into one bucket and say, there's no benefit of checkpoint inhibitors. I mean, indeed, in the RUBY trial, there was some evidence of benefit in that group. But generally, those patients have responded less well and benefited less from immune checkpoint inhibitors. I think the one trial, the other trial worth mentioning is the DUO-E trial, which included durvalumab and then in another arm, durvalumab and olaparib. And that was particularly interesting because the durvalumab and olaparib arm in the non-dMMR group did better. And that was really an interesting observation. And in fact, certainly in Europe, and I think in the US too, that has led to the approval of durvalumab and olaparib maintenance in patients who are non-dMMR.
Not actually not the combination in the US, but to
Combination.
the approval of a third immunotherapy, particularly as you say, pembrolizumab, dostarlimab, and now durvalumab as well this summer 2024. So exciting. I would love you to give us a bit of a European perspective on that, because I feel like the whole sort of HIV assault on the FDA to get accelerated approval to happen set in motion in the US a passion to get new drugs to market, which is absolutely fabulous. But there's a little bit of European reserve on when are we really impacting overall survival, and when are we sort of defining new hypotheses that we want to pursue, say, for example, augmenting an immune response in the P53 mutated tumors with a PARP inhibitor. There's other RUBY2, there's other studies coming out that are going to sort of strengthen that. How do you think about that? When is that high bar overall survival? When is it sort of academic exploration? When is it time to say to the patient, this looks really promising?
Look, I think the regulators do change their thinking, which makes it very difficult for us sometimes as clinicians, and I'm sure it makes it difficult for the industry too. I mean, I think the EMA has not been wedded to differences in overall survival. And indeed, many trials, and I'm speaking now not only in endometrial cancer, but let's say ovarian cancer too, many trials have received approval on the basis of a PFS benefit through the EMA. And the EMA, many years ago, it was a time when I was sitting on their oncology advisory group, introduced this secondary endpoint called PFS2. And the idea of that was to look, what was happening beyond progression. Was the drug still carrying over some benefit to the next progression? Because, survival data weren't there. And that was accepted by the EMA to support licensing of drugs on the basis of PFS before we had OS data. And this was something I think that didn't happen in the US, and the FDA did not accept PFS2 as that endpoint. And as a consequence of this, perhaps, if I can just divert to ovarian cancer, another, area of gynecological cancer where there's been huge change in the last decade, the FDA, reversed its decision about approving some of the PARP inhibitors in the non-BRCA groups of patients on the basis that there was no difference in overall survival, or even, the hazard ratio in some of the trials crossed one. Whereas the EMA did not change the licensing of the drugs that they had previously agreed to license on the basis of PFS and PFS2. And so there's that difference that exists between the EMA and the FDA at the moment. I think one of the other differences is, and you mentioned this right at the beginning of this question, is this accelerated approval, which does exist in the US and is easier to get than it is with the EMA. And so some of the drugs which were approved, for example, when pembrolizumab was improved in a sort of agnostic form for dMMR tumors, including endometrial cancer, that wasn't the case in the EMA. And there was no approval until the NRG18 study came through, which was a randomized study. So I think they're a bit more cautious initially, but then perhaps a little bit more lenient at that point where, you see the primary endpoint of PFS.
As positive, yeah. So, actually, to drag it back to endometrial cancer, if you could talk around KEYNOTE-B21, because exactly as you said, that concern about a lack of advantage for that sort of bad term, proficient mismatch repair, that hazard ratio was 1.2. And so I can remember at ESMO 2024, they're thinking, that's the whole same story again. How do we weigh the staggering benefit for the patients with a deficient mismatch repair tumor? And then, maybe there's consequences. And in B21, it was over 1,000 patients. 814 were in that group with pMMR tumors.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was obviously a sort of a disappointing result because here, we're talking about bringing checkpoint inhibitors, a little bit earlier in, and giving checkpoint inhibitors instead of chemotherapy. That's the other area that's really been looked at. So that study, in Europe we call them ENGOT-EN11, was disappointing in that it didn't show any improvement. Although in the dMMR subgroup, which was unfortunately not powered, there was clearly a difference, and there was an effect of the checkpoint inhibitor that wasn't seen across the piece.
So when you talk to a patient, I know. So I have. We are about to start our fifth CAR T cell study, and quite often I will say my sort of little rubric to patients is in the gynecological world, immunotherapy has been a hard slog, a late won battle, but it gives us that taste for improving the chance of cure, and then the hope is cellular therapy is going to come in and really like mop up cancer cells. That's sort of my pitch to patients. I hate to say, well, maybe there's a 3% chance of cure when you're really not sure that they're really is. When you talk to patients in terms of that, is in the back of your mind that like large majority who like aren't you're going to, there's not going to be a difference in that chance of being cured, or it does the hope for those few truly who, say, with oligometastatic disease, I definitely talk about a 20 to 40% chance with oligometastatic recurrent endometrial cancer that is deficient mismatch repair. Truly, there's not going to be a recurrence in the future. How do you frame that for yourself in terms of hope and patients in terms of choices?
So, I mean, I think in that dMMR group, we are seeing a proportion of patients who really are having a long-term benefit. The curves are flattening off for a proportion of patients. There are still patients, who have dMMR high tumor mutational burden and yet don't really do all that well with checkpoint inhibitors. And of course, we've also got the group in the recurrent setting, who may have pembrolizumab and lenvatinib as also a treatment. And within that group too, there are some patients who do extraordinarily well. As with so many things in oncology, we only understand what, sorry, our understanding is really only the tip of the iceberg of understanding the biology. And there are certain things that we hang on to, such as that dMMR status, which we know is going to be very beneficial to patients, for many patients, but unfortunately not all. So, my approach to patients really is obviously to discuss with them the biological characteristics of their disease. And as I said earlier, nearly all our patients would have a full screen for those biological factors, which would dictate not only the pathway in terms of treatment, but give some idea of what the prognosis might be. So in those dMMR patients who then go on to have an immune checkpoint inhibitor, I would say to them, look, in some cases, patients do extremely well, and we're going to have to just see how things pan out. But there are many, many factors that we don't understand. I mean, coming back to your point about oligometastatic disease, I mean, I think you're right. This is a different biology, and we see it not only in endometrial cancer, but we see it, I think, also in ovarian cancer. It's a biology that perhaps we didn't used to see in ovarian cancer. And our approach to it is different to patients who've got full-blown systemic relapse. Patients do very well with a more tailored therapy.
Yeah, I was interested in your comment about chemotherapy-free options, and so B21, LEAP-001 was a take it upfront study, and comparing paclitaxel carboplatin with lenvatinib pembrolizumab. And some people see that as like disappointing. Other people see it as, well, if you've had paclitaxel carboplatin before, it really does look like this non-chemo option has a real role. Give me a sense of how you saw that data.
Well, again, sort of was disappointed the result. We all realize how poor chemotherapy is on its own for endometrial cancer, and it has considerable toxicity in many of these patients. So there's a hope that we can dispense with chemotherapy, and so the LEAP-001 trial was a very brave study to try and do that. Lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, so to capture all the patients from what was known about pembrolizumab and lenvatinib in recurrent endometrial cancer, putting it up against chemotherapy. And as we all know, it didn't show a benefit. Of course, it did in the dMMR population, but unfortunately, the trial was not powered to do that. And that was a big error, I think, in the design of the study. Because and I don't know how many more patients they would have needed, but had they had more patients to ensure that that subgroup had sufficient power, then we could have at least said in that dMMR subgroup there is a benefit of immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy without the need for chemotherapy. Now, there are two other studies ongoing at the moment that are looking at this same question of chemotherapy versus immune therapy, but they are confined to that smaller dMMR subgroup.
Yeah.
So it'll be really interesting to see the results of those
Yeah.
studies. Those studies will be powered properly, and it may well be that when we see the results of those two studies, we may, in that dMMR group, which is just over 25% or so of endometrial cancers, actually be thinking along the lines of not using these patients, not giving these patients chemotherapy at the outset.
Yeah, no, I think lessons learned. I hear you. So, a little bit of flattery and then a difficult question. So, I don't know what you're most proud of in your career, but from my perspective, you are the embodiment of sort of erudite commitment to advancing the field, and and you're also outstandingly kind. And I think the third th strength I really see in you is your ability to be a team builder, which is. It's so important. But that intuitive
I'm blushing. Nobody can see it, but
that your intuitive ability to go ag against the flow in ovarian cancer, where it was all about chemo is poison, Gordon Rustin's observation that less is more in terms of quality of life and survival, and then seeing the potential of PARP inhibitors as a switch maintenance as opposed to therapy. Looking at all the data at the moment, do you have an intuition about whether ADCs are just going to redefine chemotherapy, whether it's all about a homogeneous small population of specifically defined molecular markers? What can we sort of like distill from you your sense of where the next big breakthroughs are going to come?
yeah. So I mean, sort of reverting back to ovarian cancer now, I think in terms of the ADCs, and that's where where we've seen a lot of activity. I think we've sort of got to a plateau with PARP inhibitors, unfortunately. I mean, for some patients, it's been absolutely fantastic, and of course we're using them more and more in the frontline setting rather than recurrent disease. But we're still faced with the fact that nearly half the patients on PARP inhibitors, including a high proportion of patients with a BRCA mutation, will have a recurrence. And so we have to manage that. And I think that is a challenge. And I think there are several strategies that we can look at. One is to sort of build on what we know is a problem within the tumor, which is the repair of DNA damage. And so, can we use PARP inhibitor plus something else to actually work claw back that inability to repair the DNA properly, and lead to genomic instability and synthetic cell death? Or should we be switching tack and saying, well, in those patients who fail the PARP inhibitor, let's look at an ADC approach. And we're beginning now to see a number of potential targets for ADC. Of course, the first one we saw was the folate receptor, but there are others, of course, coming through. Some very exciting data, with TROP2 and also with anti-HER2 ADCs and so on, and more down the pipeline. But then the question is, where to place these agents best? We're still faced with the problem of approximately 50% of these women with advanced disease having a recurrence even after a PARP inhibitor. Is it something that's going to replace the chemotherapy for recurrent disease, or is it something again that we should be looking at building on the responses that we see with chemotherapy and using them more in the maintenance setting? And that is a Of course, an unanswered question at the moment. My personal preference would be to go for a maintenance setting. Although, having said that, the pattern of toxicity of some of these ADCs, is very different from the pattern of toxicity that we saw from PARP inhibitors. Not least of which is the fact that they're not oral drugs. And of course, that was one of the big attractions of a maintenance approach with a PARP inhibitor. But nevertheless, for a period of time, and I don't know how long that period of time is, that there may still be a route to use the ADCs as maintenance to build on the effect of surgery plus or minus, sorry, chemotherapy plus or minus surgery in the recurrent disease setting, rather than saying, you know, this is going to substitute for chemotherapy. Now, it may, but I suspect it won't. And I suspect that we need something of a longer duration to sustain those remissions that we see in recurrent ovarian cancer.
With endometrial cancer and that sort of question of the duration of therapy, 2 years with pembrolizumab, 3 years with dostarlimab, 35 cycles with other strategies. Do you have a bias in off protocol treatment of patients? Do you have a strategy of how you continuously treat people or treat for a duration or PET-CT scan or biopsy? What's your approach?
No, so I mean, you know, look, we're at the early stage of using these outside of clinical trials. I mean, the licensing has only just come through, so I think there needs to be a familiarity that we get with the treatment and a recognition of the potential toxicity to patients of, you know, to have 36 months of dostarlimab, never mind the financial toxicity, but you know, to the effect of it coming up every 6 weeks for infusions and so on. You know, I think it would be really great for the academic community. I think once they've really got to grips with these agents and giving them for that period of time, to actually think about setting up trials to reduce the amount of time patients on treatment. And of course, this was done. It's not my area at all, but I think perhaps yours in with Herceptin, you know, where the trials were done to reduce the amount of therapy with Herceptin, and it's been done in chemotherapy in colon cancer, adjuvant therapy for colon cancer. So, of course, these are areas that need to be explored by the academic community because it's not going to be easy to get industry on board with that. But I think there's a role for us to do this and to try and understand better how long these patients really need to be on a drug to fully have the benefit of the treatment.
Fabulous. Unfortunately, it is time to wrap up our discussion. So, just to summarize what we talked about today, and thank you, Jonathan, the molecular subclassifications of endometrial cancer have really redefined for us how to generate data in these different groups, data that really applies to patients in clinic. And we really want to encourage patients to participate in clinical trials, especially at a time when checkpoint inhibitors have transformed outcomes for patients, especially patients with deficient mismatch repair tumors. To receive CME CE credit for today's program, complete the post-test and evaluation, and you'll be able to download and print your certificate immediately upon completion. Remember, this is the second of a six-part podcast series on gynecologic cancers with world experts. Next month, I'll be hosting a discussion on biomarker testing in ovarian cancer, and I hope you'll be able to join us. We'll be archiving this and future podcasts in this series on the Oncology Hub at cmeoutfitters.com, where you can find a number of excellent resources for clinicians and patients. And again, thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much for having me, Richard.
Thank you for joining me for this very important discussion. And thank you to our audience, you, for tuning in today and for providing the best care for patients with endometrial cancer.